Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical, underage sale prohibited. Introducing Zone Nicotine Pouches, the perfect balance of unparalleled comfort, longer-lasting flavor, and nicotine that satisfies. Whether you're zoning in during the race or zoning out after a tough day at work, Zone gets you there faster and keeps you there longer. Available in 7 flavors and in 6 and 9 milligram strengths. Find Zone at ZonePouches.com and retailers near you. Own your Zone with Zone Nicotine Pouches.
This season, Toyota Racing is looking for jugglers.
Aha!
Not the ones who toss balls or rings. Fans that can juggle the rigors of a 10-month-long season across many different racing circuits.
Well, what if I added knives?
What if you added GR Cup, Formula Drift, and off-road racing? If you can juggle it all, then we want you. Be part of the action at toyota.com/racing. Toyota, let's go places. Formula Drift is a registered trademark of Formula Drifts Holdings, LLC.
It was a season that saw seeds planted by a legend bloom on the biggest stage possible.
I still think of 2004 as part of the healing from 2001.
This has got to be the greatest day of my life.
A season that brought out the best.
We're right in the middle of this championship, so we'll just see what happens at Homestead.
And the worst.
And now they're tackling one another, and a fight is on in the pit area.
While crowning a champion in the most suspenseful way.
We dodged a huge, huge, devastating proposition that would have taken us out of this championship.
A racing season that was one of the most impactful in the sport's history.
There's so much going on behind the scenes in 04, but the headlines that made the sport continue, I think we'll be 25 years from now when we're celebrating the 100th, somebody will look at a yardstick of our history and 2004 is going to be on there.
Motor Racing Network welcomes you to NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. Hello, everyone. I'm Mike Bagley, and welcome into Episode 8 of NASCAR Live Presents 2004, Chasing History. In Episode 7, we chronicled the first three races of the chase for the Nextel Cup. Those races included Kurt Busch announcing himself as a championship contender with a win at New Hampshire, Ryan Newman's dominant win at Dover, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. being penalized by NASCAR after cursing in victory lane at Talladega. This week, we dive into the aftermath of that penalty, as well as races 4 through 6 of the chase. Those three races include teammate tension and an underdog victory at Kansas. Jimmy Johnson returning to a track that many would call his own personal playground, and an incomprehensible tragedy at the Martinsville Speedway. But let's start with the aftermath of the penalty Dale Earnhardt Jr. received at Talladega. The 25-point penalty was the first of its kind at that scale, and one that took Jr. out of the points lead. Even though Ray Evernham had one of his own cars in the chase, he considered that penalty harsh.
Fortunately, I didn't really have drivers at that time that I had to worry about, and crew chiefs, I don't know that I would have agreed with a point penalty, but I understand why they had to take a hard line. And sometimes you make a rule and you realize you've gone too far and you got to back up a little bit. I think everybody gets the message now. We certainly can't have language like that on national television, but that might have been a little bit harsh on Junior that year.
The biggest beneficiary of that penalty was Kurt Busch. Kurt was vaulted into the lead after the penalty, but remembers telling his team there was much, much more work to be done.
You know, when we took the points lead in the 2004 playoff run, it was when Dale Jr. used a cuss word at Talladega and was docked 25 points. That was the moment we inherited the points lead. And I remember going into the race shop saying, we're technically not the points leader. He shouldn't have got fined. It's 25 points, whatever. We still have work to do. Let's stay focused, keep the blinders on, let's keep digging.
That work would begin on October 10th, 2004 at Kansas Speedway. Practice and qualifying that weekend were an eye-opener. Jeremy Mayfield was extremely fast in practice and hungry to turn things around after a rough start to the chase. But Mayfield and the 9 other chasers we're all led to the green flag by pole sitter Joe Nemechek.
Here comes the field working off turn 4. The Ford Pace car is on the pit lane and for the call. For the start of the Banquet 400, here's Barney Hall.
267 laps about to unfold here at the Kansas Speedway. Green flag is in the air and Joe Nemechek takes him to turn 1. Casey Kane, Jeremy Mayfield, and Jimmy Johnson jockey with him for the lead spot over to 2.
Nemechek led the first 4 laps of the race, but after that, Mayfield showed that his speed in practice was no fluke.
Here's the battle for the lead at the start-finish line. It is Jeremy Mayfield diving underneath Joe Nemechek. They are still side-by-side going to turn one.
Mayfield's got that advantageous low line, but Joe Nemechek keeps it wound up tight in the outside lane. Advantage down low. Give the lead off turn two to Jeremy Mayfield.
And he'll pull away by two car lengths, make it three car lengths at the end of the back straightaway now as Nemechek settles in the second spot.
While Mayfield was able to take the lead early on, Kurt Busch was hungry to get his number 97 car to the front and claim the five bonus points that were awarded for leading a lap. Busch started 22nd on the day, and one of the cars he had to pass on the way to the front was his teammate and fellow Chase competitor Matt Kenseth. Kurt remembers closing in on Matt, but growing frustrated when he wasn't able to get around him as quickly as he hoped.
It was a unique dynamic. It wasn't hostile, but it was tough because when the playoffs started and a teammate just lets you pass over the regular season for a position or let you lead a lap to gain those points, I remember at Kansas in the playoffs, Kenseth would not let me buy for one lap lead. I just wanted one lap lead just to put it in the bank. He would not pull over. I burned up my right front because I got angry. I got cranky. Like, I'm on the radio going, where's our teamwork? There's five of us here working together to win this championship. And Fenning said, Reiser said, that Matt said, you ain't passing me. You got to pass me. We're not laying over. Oh, I was cranky. That started some things. And yet, that's when it's like, okay, mano y mano. This is what helped me. Mark Martin helped me calm down afterwards. He says, Kurt, we work together 6 days out of the week, and we go race on the seventh. And I said, yes, sir, I got it. And in my head, I'm like, I can beat these guys 60% of the time just by showing up on Sunday. So that's where you get back into your own team, your own car number, and you do it for your own guys.
Though Busch definitely had a tendency to get heated during competition, Matt always considered Kurt a great teammate.
I'll say, I was fortunate enough to be teammates with, Kurt and Kyle. And those are two very different people as far as personalities away from the track, just very different people. However, their approach to racing, their work ethic, their enthusiasm, the effort they put in, all that stuff is like, honestly, it's like second to none. I mean, they work on it really hard and they take it really serious. And, like I said, they're very different, but they were both really great teammates. So I know what you're saying about Kurt, and it maybe seems like that from the outside. And I think certainly there's been, I'm sure personal up and downs in his life. But even my last year, I went back and raced at Ganassi during the COVID year. Kurt was there as well. And he was the same guy that I worked with 20 years before that. I mean, he was at every meeting. He's plugged in. He has great feedback, great information. I was trying to help you. I was trying to make his team better. And besides all that, just massively talented guy.
Though Busch had struggles getting around Kenseth, he was able to get those bonus points he was after when he led lap 79. The day of ups and downs for Busch continued, though, when he found himself in some trouble just past the halfway mark of the race.
Trouble on the back straightaway. One car spins around right in the face of Ricky Rudd. It's Kurt Busch. Slides the length of the back straightaway. Everybody taking evasive action. Jimmy Johnson gets gathered up. He gets spun down into the grass.
Caution on the speedway. Let's go back to the backstretch.
Kurt Busch got turned around in a heavy pack of traffic at the exit of turn number two, Barney. Spun the half the length of the back straightaway. Ricky Rudd forced to lock up the brakes to try and avoid him. Rudd very fortunate to get through without getting tagged. Jimmy Johnson also got turned around in the evasive action. All the cars have now gone on their way.
Even though that was a close call for both Kurt and Jimmy Johnson, the same could not be said when Ryan Newman found himself in similar trouble later in the race.
Meanwhile, Ken Schrader with some problems. Looks like maybe a cut tire.
Whoa, we got a spin off turn number four. Ryan Newman loses it coming off the corner, spins around, goes down on the grass, and will spin the car at least four or five times. Don't believe he made contact with anybody else. And we'll keep it in a straight line, and the yellow flag is out yet one more time. So caution is on the speedway.
One of the contenders for the chase for the Nextel Cup. Looks like maybe a cut tire for Ryan Newman as well. Now as we see he passes by the start-finish line, the right rear is down. There is some damage to the rear of his Mobil 1 machine. And Ryan Newman, one of the contenders in the chase for the Nextel Cup with problems. We just told you Ken Schrader apparently had similar issues coming off turn two. His car slowed, was off the pace, and came down pit lane to make a stop.
Newman wouldn't be the only chaser to not finish the event. Jimmy Johnson would not have the same luck as earlier in the race when he spun coming off turn two for the second time.
digging hard, trying to get himself a spot back. McMurray trapped on the outside with Robbie Gordon down low.
Side by side to the back straightaway.
Trouble off turn two. Jimmy Johnson is around, and he slams into the outside wall. Heavy damage on the low Chevrolet for Jimmy Johnson as he does a wild slide down through the grass.
And as the field comes off turn number four, they're going to see the yellow flag waving. It is the seventh time this afternoon. The caution is out at lap 213. Let's go back to turn two.
Again, Barney, trouble at the exit of turn two in heavy traffic, and one of the championship contenders involved, Jimmy Johnson, got turned around. The car spun a complete 360, nosed into the outside retaining wall, then went on a wild slide for life, the length of the back straightaway down in the infield grass. Heavy damage on the low Chevrolet. Jimmy Johnson just now refiring the car and pulling away.
How about that? Within about five laps, we have two championship contenders with problems. Ryan Newman's car back in the garage. They're working on the Altel Dodge, and now Jimmy Johnson. After having problems earlier this afternoon, they had recovered, had worked their way back into the top 15, and now having problems once again.
While Mayfield showed speed earlier, the race was extremely competitive in terms of leaders. Greg Biffle and Jamie McMurray also proved to be contenders, but it was Elliott Sadler who found himself out front with less than 40 laps to go. Closing quickly in his rearview mirror, Joe Nemechek, who was trying to get back to the point for the first time since lap four.
We told you there was a furious battle at the front of the field, and indeed there is. Elliott Sadler has just grabbed the lead. Joe Nemechek is scooted up to second. Jamie McMurray is third. Pick him up in turn one.
It's a four-man bare-knuckler right now. Sadler the leader. Nemechek second. Ricky Rudd takes the long way around. Here's Nemechek for the lead.
Side by side, Ford and Chevy off the end of the back straightaway. Nemechek charges hard, coming into the corner, and he'll pick up the lead. Elliott Sadler falls back to second, or will he? Here he comes back to the inside in four.
Elliott drops down to the inside, crosses over, goes back after Joe Nemechek, and gets by him here at the start-finish line. But Nemechek's not finished yet. He pulls back along on the outside lane, dead even in turn one.
No quit in G.I. Joe as he climbs the ladder to the outside lane. Sadler gets a little bit sideways. Side by side, off turn number two for the lead.
Rolls reversed this time. Now Nemechek uses the outside lane. Sadler down low. Ricky Rudd and Jamie McMurray factors. Here's Nemechek around the outside. He'll grab the lead in three, but again, Elliott Sadler charges back to the bottom.
36 laps to go, but the way they're racing, you'd think this was the final lap. They come back down to the line, and Joe Nemechek, who started on the Bud pole, hangs onto the lead.
Two late race cautions prevented Nemechek from pulling away, and while it seemed like we would see a non-chaser win this race, we didn't know who that would be, as Joe Nemechek had to hold off a hard-charging Ricky Rudd in the closing laps.
Side by side for the lead. Ricky Rudd, Joe Nemechek door to door, and Nemechek charges in harder on the outside, but Rudd is still there in turn four.
Joe ran in real hard, held on to the lead for a second, and then he drifted up a little bit, and Ricky was able to get a fender underneath him. White flag, they've got one lap to go, and that would have been an absolute dead heat if it had been the final lap, but it's not. They're still racing for the lead down in turn one.
Ricky Rudd clinging to the white line at the bottom. Joe Nemechek letting it ride on the outside for the final time off two, and Nemechek by half a car length.
Ricky Rudd's got to come out of the gas. He falls in line behind Nemechek off the end of the back straightaway. This is the dash for the checkered flag. Nemechek leads by three car lengths. Ricky Rudd loses ground to him in turn four.
Chevrolet has won the previous three races here at Kansas Speedway. Looks like they're going to do it again as Joe Nemechek comes to the line. Rudd makes one final run to the inside. Can't quite pull up alongside. And Joe Nemechek goes to victory lane in the Banquet 400, picking up the victory, his first since May of last year in Richmond, Virginia. Let's go to his pit.
And the celebration begins. The tears start flowing. Ryan Pemberton, Jay Fry, the entire U.S. Army team high-fiving, celebrating out on pit road. And Joe Nemechek going to victory lane for the fourth time in his career.
Well, it's a very popular Gatorade victory lane, Barney. Who needs Toto when you got an army of one? Joe Nemechek, congratulations on your win. Getting a hug from Ryan Pemberton, his crew chief. Any concerns about fuel those last few laps?
Well, Ryan had me saving gas the whole time, and I was doing my best to save gas, and I thought I had a real big lead, and I just started backing up trying to save gas. We were running really fast lap times, and next thing I know, here's a white hood and a red car in my mirror, and I'm like, where in the world did he come from? And so I had to get back after it. Ricky came up and gave me a heck of a challenge there at the end. Incredible. Roman Pemberton, my spotter. Awesome job, man. That's just an incredible day. I don't know what to say.
Joining Joe in that victory lane celebration was his son and now current Cup Series driver, John Hunter Nemechek. That wasn't the only time Front Row Joe visited victory lane that weekend. He had also won the Busch Series race the day before, and John Hunter remembers celebrating both big wins with his dad as a seven-year-old.
Man, Kansas 2004, I guess I was 7 years old, somewhere around there. I remember being on the playground for the Xfinity race and the Cup race, and we won both. So that was really cool getting to go to Victory Lane twice in one weekend, taking home two trophies. I think he won the pole. I can't remember if he won the pole in the Xfinity race or the Cup race, but I remember getting to take home the pedal car as well. So it was a lot of trophies that weekend and a lot of celebrations. So super neat to be able to sweep the weekend.
While Joe Nemechek going to Victory Lane for the first time in over a year was the biggest headline coming out of Kansas, number two on that list was the points battle. After spinning out earlier in the race, Kurt Busch rebounded to finish sixth and extended his points lead to 29 over Dale Jr. At the other end of the spectrum, Jimmy Johnson, who found himself ninth in points after finishing 32nd and a whopping 247 points behind Busch with six races remaining. The good news for Johnson, though, was the next race on the schedule took place in Concord, North Carolina at the then-named Lowe's Motor Speedway. The same company also adorned the hood and quarter panels of Johnson's 48 car in those days. In a fitting turn of events, that Lowe's car was beginning to show dominance at the mile-and-a-half oval. By this point, Johnson was already a two-time Coca-Cola 600 winner and added to his Charlotte win total when he won the 2004 UAW GM Quality 500. MRN's Alex Hayden remembers that feeling of invincibility Johnson and crew chief Chad Knaus had in Charlotte back in those days, and even recounts a story about Johnson and Charlotte that was vital to the future seven-time champion's career.
With Jimmy racing at Charlotte Motor Speedway, is he was one that could rise to the occasion, especially when there was a lot of pressure on the line. His sponsor at the time, Lowe's, was a sponsor of the racetrack, Lowe's Motor Speedway at Charlotte. Hendrick Motorsports was based and still is just across the street from Charlotte Motor Speedway. So there's an enormous amount of pressure there. Obviously, Lowe's at the time, when he was sponsored by them and they sponsored the racetrack, their headquarters are in the greater Charlotte, North Carolina area. So a ton of pressure to rise to the occasion there. Not to mention the fact that Jimmy made his very first NASCAR Cup Series start at Charlotte Motor Speedway. And it was a very difficult weekend. I mean, he was in the second Lowe's car. The regular Lowe's car had a hard time making the show. And Jimmy goes out and qualifies 15th, I believe it was, if memory serves right, and puts the car in the field and has a good run going early on. And there's good and bad, there's sad, there's happy, all mixed in with his first Cup start at Charlotte, because one of his best friends off the racetrack, a young man by the name of Blaze Alexander, was killed in a crash at Charlotte that same weekend. Jimmy was set to make his first career Cup start. So Jimmy was racing with an extremely heavy heart, and that added pressure as well. He wanted to do well in honor of his late great friend, Blaze Alexander. The fun story out of all that is Jimmy may not have had the career he had if he would have wrecked Jeff Gordon in that first Cup start at Charlotte Motor Speedway. He had one job, and his only instructions coming from Rick Hendrick was, don't wreck the 24 of Jeff Gordon. Because keep in mind, Gordon was trying to win another championship that year. That was in the fall race at Charlotte, and Gordon was in position to try to win yet another championship. And they told Jimmy, go out and have a blast. Have fun. Learn. Just one responsibility. Don't wreck Jeff Gordon. And ironically enough, Jimmy spins in turns 3 and 4, backs it up, and hits the outside wall with the back of the race car. And Jeff Gordon was directly behind him and had to slam on the brakes. If Gordon would have hit Jimmy, who knows if Jimmy would have been fired from the ride, and maybe all this would have been a completely different story. But as it turns out, Gordon stood on the brakes and was able to avoid the wrecking Johnson car. And I guess they say the rest is history.
While the win was certainly a step in the right direction for Johnson, he wasn't able to gain much ground on Busch. Matter of fact, Kurt continued his string of consistency. He finished fourth at Charlotte, meaning Johnson only cut his deficit to Busch by 20 points, from 247 to 227. The second half of the chase for the Nextel Cup started the next weekend at the Martinsville Speedway, a track where Rusty Wallace scored an emotional victory earlier that season. While ending a long winless streak was a huge weight off Rusty's shoulders, he remembers the rest of the season being miserable after failing to qualify for the chase.
It was miserable because, you know, I in my mind told me don't quit. And my crew chief, Larry Carter, and all the guys were saying, man, don't leave us hanging out to dry here. He said, we're doing really good right now. And we're, you know, we were dry, running dry, like you said. You know, we didn't win again after that, but we had great runs. We weren't running bad. We run pretty doggone good, you know, run up front quite a bit. But it was just knowing that the end's coming and is this the right decision or not was a tough one.
Even though Rusty entered the weekend in Martinsville 18th in the point standings, he still had to be considered a contender to win the race and even qualified on the front row alongside his teammate Ryan Newman. While it was certainly a great sight for Roger Penske to see both of his cars on the front row, according to Rusty, there was tension behind the scenes between the teams.
Real good driver, still a great driver. We just never saw eye to eye. Our ages are way different. Our interest was way different. That was the age where all the computers were really coming on big time. He embraced it. I didn't embrace it so much. He had a crew chief that was Matt Borland, which is a really super smart guy. But just his approach to setting a car up was different. They were real private. I was the type of guy that talked to a lot of drivers. We always compared setups and we threw numbers back and forth. They didn't like any of that. They didn't want to share any of that information with any other drivers. And I had a great relationship with Mark Martin, had a great relationship with Jeff Burton. Had a great relationship with even Earnhardt. We would say, hey, Modi, we got a new car. I said, what kind of setup do you have in your car? And I'd say, oh, I got a 1500 right front. I got a 1000 left front. I got a 2-inch sway bar. And I would tell them the truth, and they would tell me the truth. And there's many times that I couldn't get my car handling right, and I'm running out of time to practice. And I'd run over to Mark Martin and say, hey, man, what do you got in that car? He'd give me the whole setup, and I'd run back, and I'd put it in my car. Whew. I said, that fixed it, and I'm pretty good now, you know. Stuff like that. But with Ryan and Matt, they were very, very private. Wouldn't say nothing to anybody, you know, cover everything up, all that type of stuff. And I just couldn't race like that. And we just never got along real well. And I appreciate his abilities and all that, but we were just so different and hardly ever worked together. And Penske hated it because he was probably the best at the team concept of everybody sharing this and sharing that. You know, it got to where they wouldn't even share, you know. I remember one time it got so heated that I went over to ask him something, and Borland said, I'm not going to tell you. I said, why? Well, I said, I'm part owner of this team. He said, I don't care. He said, you're going to take it right over to Mark Martin and give it to him. And that was probably the last deal right there that set me off. And I said, okay. And I went to Roger, and Roger was like pulling his hair like, oh, shoot, what am I going to do now, you know? But it got to where they were so private with their setups. And, it came and go. You know, there was times when he was kicking our butt. And then there was times when, we were faster. And so it's just the way they did it, but it wasn't the way I did it. And so the relationship never did work out.
While Newman and Rusty both led early on in the Subway 500, it seemed like the race never truly got rolling. The race featured a rash of cautions, including 5 in the first 100 laps of the race. One of the longest green flag runs of the race took place from lap 114 to lap 183. The driver who dominated that stint was the points leader.
Sterling Marlin has the spot for now, but here goes Kurt Busch for the top spot. Kurt Busch down to the inside. He'll take the lead in turn 3.
A lead change at lap 130 here at Martinsville.
While Busch getting to the lead wasn't a surprise, what was a surprise was the only Hendrick Motorsports car to lead in the first half of the race was Terry Labonte. Their two championship contenders, Jeff Gordon and Jimmy Johnson, could not be held down, though. They found their way to the front as the race neared its conclusion.
Green flag is in the air. McMurray shows the way. Joe Nemechek is putting the pressure on, trying to get back on the tail end of the lead lap. He runs McMurray all the way up the track in turn 2.
Up the racetrack, McMurray goes, and Nemechek's digging hard down to the inside, and Jeff Gordon is there. Gordon to the inside. They're side by side for the lead.
Jeff Gordon takes advantage of the fact that he is caught in that high lane, and Jamie McMurray finds himself back in second place all of a sudden.
Jimmy sizes him up, looks to the outside, can't make the move there. Right up on the bumper of that Dodge off turn 2.
Follows his tire track to the back straightaway, trying to see what Jimmy Johnson's going to do. He will break out of line, charge hard into turn 3, and to the lead, Jimmy Johnson goes in turn 4.
While a quarter of this race would ultimately be run under the caution flag, it was surprisingly clean for chase contenders. That was until the final 100 laps of the race. The first chaser to find himself in trouble was Elliott Sadler.
For the 14th time this afternoon in the running of the Subway 500, the caution flag is flying at Martinsville Speedway, this time for an incident in turn four.
Elliott Sadler was trying to make the pass on Robbie Gordon. The two slapped together. Gordon slid up the racetrack. Elliott Sadler spun out all by himself. No one else was collected in that solo spin by Elliott Sadler.
That crash was a huge blow to Sadler's championship hopes. The Robert Yates Racing driver was probably the biggest surprise of the chase up to that point. He entered the race fourth in the point standings. Less than 15 laps after Sadler's troubles, the driver who entered Martinsville second in points found himself in trouble of his own.
Trouble in turn two. Kyle Petty goes around. Contact with Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. doesn't spin. He's got a lot of damage, though, to the right side of the Budweiser Chevrolet. Make that the left side. And Kyle Petty now rights his car in turn two.
Caution is on the speedway the 15th time this afternoon. Again, it happened over in turn two.
Kyle Petty snapped around Barney, and at that same time, Dale Earnhardt Jr. was trying to make the pass on the outside, and Kyle came up and tagged the left side of the Budweiser Chevrolet. A lot of damage to Dale's car. He's got smoke billowing from it. He's on pit road. Kyle as well has limited damage, but the one that's worse for wear on that exchange was definitely Dale Earnhardt Jr.
Dale Jr. and Sadler both lost more than 100 points to Kurt Busch that day, but in the final same 100 laps where they had their troubles, another driver was looking to gain ground on Busch and asserted dominance accordingly.
Maybe not for long. Jimmy Johnson's going for the lead in turn two.
Charges hard coming into the corner, and they're side by side. Here is Sterling Marlin on the outside. Jimmy Johnson down low. Fender out in front. Johnson goes back to the lead here in Martinsville.
Jimmy Johnson just out horsepower. Sterling.
After working on the car all day long, Jimmy Johnson and Chad Knaus had finally found that sweet spot and took the lead. Hopefully for good. With 60 laps to go, Johnson's path to victory lane wasn't a smooth one, though, as the 17th and final caution flag flew after an incident involving Carl Edwards and Robbie Gordon. The field then geared up for a final seven-lap dash to the checkers. Johnson was able to hold off all challengers and capture the first of what would ultimately be nine checkered flags at Martinsville.
They come out of turn four. White flag goes in the air. One more lap around. Jimmy Johnson has an advantage of maybe four car lengths as he heads down into turns one and two, but the scramble may be for second place.
Contact is made. Here's Jamie McMurray rooting and gouging to the inside of Ryan Newman. They are drag racing for the second spot off the end of the back straightaway while Jimmy Johnson comes off turn four looking for the checkered flag.
A walk in the park for Jimmy Johnson. No one anywhere close to him. He comes to the line and wins the Subway 500. His second win in a row.
Immediately after the checkered flag flew, the tone and the tenor at the racetrack immediately changed. Jimmy Johnson did not celebrate the victory with a burnout, but instead immediately returned to pit road at the request of his crew chief, Chad Knaus. News had begun to trickle out that a plane carrying multiple Hendrick Motorsports employees had crashed near the racetrack. MRN Pit reporters Adam Alexander and Winston Kelly both remember the rumors of the crash beginning near the midpoint of the race.
Well, where it's a little bit different on pit road, you know, we started hearing the same thing on pit road, but I was able to validate from some people that what was being talked about was likely true. Now, nobody would say, yeah, this is what it was, but we heard enough of that it was a plane crash, and finally later heard that it was a Hendrick plane, that what they were hearing about, that, you know, I didn't get a final confirmation until after the race. You know, Jimmy won the race, and I'd been told by somebody from NASCAR that they're not going to do any post-race interviews, that they need to take the driver somewhere, and we had heard on the queue, you know, we just need to talk about here's what happened, and until there's an official statement. But it was during the latter half of the race that we were pretty sure on pit road that something tragic had happened, and we felt like from what we were hearing it was a Hendrick plane. We had no idea the magnitude of it, that it was 10 people that were on the plane.
I don't remember the exact stage of the race, somewhere middle portion I would guess, but I was starting to see a lot of activity on pit road from people there on the NASCAR side that I never would normally see on pit road during a race. That made me think something doesn't seem right here. I don't recall what drivers I was covering that day. I don't remember if I had Jimmy or maybe someone else in the Hendrick group. But I do remember noticing this odd activity. and odd communication. And with that, the body language of the reactions that said to me something is not right. And so I remember during a commercial break saying, as we would all communicate, you know, off air during commercial to one another, I remember saying to Danielle Fry, as you mentioned, she was one of our pit reporters, but Danielle came to us after doing a long stint at NASCAR, had deep relationships there, was very respected at NASCAR. I remember saying to Danielle, Danielle, at the next commercial, you know, come see me. She said, okay. So she came down and I said, I think something's going on. And I remember her reaction was like, something's wrong with the car. Do you think the engine's going bad? I'm like, no, it's not like that. Like something is up that is not right. And only you could probably go and investigate this. And I remember even saying to her, like, this is not a story for the air. This is just a story to understand what is going on here.
The Hendrick drivers and crew chief had no inclination of what had happened until after the checkered flag flew. Chad Canales remembers thinking that his team was in trouble with the sanctioning body when NASCAR officials instructed him to tell Jimmy to come directly to the garage.
I didn't know until after the conclusion of the race, which was really interesting. And again, we won Martinsville. Kind of a misty day, cold day, rainy, you know, so it was just like a heavy, heavy day. So just hyper in tuned with the team and the driver. You know, what are we going to do if it rains? What are we going to do if it sprinkles? How are we going to maintain track position? How are we going to win this race? And with about, I don't remember how many laps to go, I'm going to say 25 laps to go, a NASCAR official came up, climbed up on top of the truck, or on top of my pit box, and said, hey, post-race, if you guys win this, don't do a burnout. Now, me, I'm sitting there, I'm like, what in the world's going on? You know, and I immediately take it the wrong direction. I immediately think, okay, what's NASCAR trying to do to, you know, make sure we don't hurt our car, take this win away from us? What are they trying to inspect? Like, I took it way the wrong direction. And I didn't, it never hit me. I never knew. I knew something was wrong, but I thought it was more NASCAR coming down on us to take our car from an inspection standpoint or something like, because we just whipped everybody. You know, I do remember in hindsight looking around the pit box and seeing a lot of people around the pit box that with a different expression than what I had thought. So I didn't know at that point something's going on. I just thought I was in trouble because I got in trouble a lot back then. We win the race and, you know, told Jimmy don't do any burnouts. And he came to the pit box, I believe, and he hopped out and he said, what's going on? I'm like, dude, I don't really know what's happening. And then Christine Curley, Ken Howes, and a couple others grabbed us and we walked over to the NASCAR trailer and to the, they pulled us up inside and we sat in the little office that they've got up there and they told us about what was going on there inside. So that was pretty tough.
Johnson was just as puzzled when Canales relayed that message.
When I took the checkered flag, Chad came on the radio and said in a surprised voice, he's like, NASCAR says don't do any burnouts. Screw them. Do what you want to do. Like, why are they telling you not to do burnouts? And then evidently they're scanning us and he got quiet and he comes back on. He's like, okay, hold up. They're very serious. Do not do any burnouts. Just come to pit lane. We'll figure this out. And so as I come to pit lane, I see them making a lane for the Hendrick cars. And it's not NASCAR officials waiting for us. They are police officers, men in uniform standing there. And I was like, whoa, I have never seen men in uniform waiting for race cars to come off the track before. And so as I pulled up and got, you know, pulled to a stop and I looked over, I could see my publicist at the time, Christine Curley, standing there. And her eyes and her face, she'd been crying for some time and she knew. And I knew that something really bad had happened. And so I jumped out of the car and there's a small little, I don't even know if it's still there, but it's by the concession stand. There was a little office area. And they took us into this little makeshift office area. Four drivers, four crew chiefs, and Ken Howes explained to us what happened. And at that point in time, there was optimism that they just lost touch with the aircraft. We hadn't confirmed that it had technically crashed, but you know, there was some language around lost contact with the aircraft at a certain time. It's supposed to be coming to the Martinsville Airport, and there has been no contact made, and there's a search party out looking for the plane and the people.
Winston Kelly was near Johnson's car when he returned to the garage area and remembered the puzzled look on Jimmy's face when he got out of the race car.
I was at the car or close enough to the car to see it, and his look was perplexed and confusion because they had not told him over the radio, which was part of the plan, that something is awkward and weird. But he didn't have any idea that it was that bad, but it was like a I don't know what's going on. It wasn't, you know, when you get bad news, you might have an ashen look over your face, but it's like, this is just totally different. And we all had that reaction. It's like, what do you say when you can't confirm anything because all you've heard is rumors?
While Johnson and others from Hendrick Motorsports were being summoned to the NASCAR hauler, the crowd in attendance and the MRN listening audience was still in the dark regarding what had occurred. The third member of the MRN crew on pit road that day was Danielle Fry. During the confusion, during post-race, Danielle was able to secure an interview with Jim Hunter of NASCAR, who informed the public of some of the details surrounding the tragedy.
Barney, the winner of today's race, Jimmy Johnson, along with his Hendrick teammates, have been summoned to the NASCAR hauler back here in the Nextel Cup garage. I've been joined by NASCAR Vice President of Corporate Communications, Jim Hunter. Jim, why are these guys back here?
Well, we've excused the winner from winner circle. We've been made aware that earlier today the FAA reported they lost contact with a Hendrick Motorsports airplane en route Martinsville. And they've notified the NTSB and they're investigating to see what, you know, what might have happened or what has happened. We're working very closely with members of the Hendrick organization, including we've had contact with Rick Hendrick, and we're just saying extra prayers right now for the entire Hendrick organization.
Do you have any idea who all was on that plane?
I really don't. We don't have any of the details or any information, but we'll certainly keep people informed as we gather additional information.
Jeff Gordon was also informed of what happened in the NASCAR hauler following the checkered flag and admits being somewhat in denial about what happened.
Yeah, one of the toughest days, you know, of my life, because, you know, I'm out there competing and this, you know, knowledge was out there, but not to any of us. And so I carry a little bit of guilt from that, right? Then I wanted to know. I mean, these are people that meant a lot to me, people I worked with, people that I considered family. And so to hear about it immediately when the race, I mean, it was just a very awkward end to a race. As soon as the checkered flag waved, you know, immediately, you know, they're on the radio saying, hey, you know, just get, you know, out of the car and come straight to hauler or where, or media center, where, I can't remember where they told us to come to. They told Jimmy, you know, don't celebrate the win. And so you're just immediately going, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on? And so then, you know, shortly after that, we got together and found out. And I just remember being in absolute shock. You know, you just can't believe it, because you start thinking about the people that are on that plane and people that you know, you had just talked to, or what's your last conversation or interaction was with them. And you're going, wait a minute, no, that can't be possible. I know I'm going to see this person again. I know I'm going to see him.
No victory lane, and the news of the tragedy becoming public made for one of the more somber post-race environments in history, according to NASCAR President Mike Helton.
It was probably the most somber, quiet loading of trucks after a race that was respectful of what happened. It would hardly anybody talked to each other. They just did their job. Quietly, nobody was hollering at, say, hey, go pick up this. You know, they may go pick it up themselves instead of hollering at somebody else to go pick it up. But it was the most somber, silent loading up of a race event to move on to the next one that I can remember. It sticks with you.
While Johnson, Gordon, and others were informed of the plane accident at the track, who exactly the passengers were remained unclear. Hendrick Motorsports team owner Rick Hendrick was not on board that aircraft, and Winston Kelly instantly remembered a meeting he had just days prior when he learned Mr. Hendrick wasn't on the plane.
Well, I need to back up to Friday before. So I was at Duke Power at the time, and I was responsible for all the government and community relations, and also had some involvement in economic development. And we had a meeting set up on that Friday to talk with the Hendrick folks, including Jeff Turner, who was the lead business development guy who was on the plane with Mr. Hendrick, and Mr. Hendrick, with our economic development folks, the mayor of Charlotte was a part of it, who also worked for Duke, to talk about the automotive industry and the potential for growth within the automotive industry in this area. And Mr. Hendrick came in for a few minutes because he had missed a dinner earlier that week that he was supposed to introduce and honor Bill France Jr., but he had been sick. So he came in for about 10, 15 minutes with us and apologized that he couldn't stay because he was not feeling well, but he wanted to thank us for coming. So as I learned that Mr. Hendrick was not on the plane, he was supposed to be on the plane, but he was sick and did not get on the plane. Jeff Turner was on the plane, who was in that meeting.
One of the lives that was tragically lost that day was Ricky Hendrick, Rick's son and former Craftsman Truck Series winner. Ricky was one of Jimmy Johnson's best friends and one of the biggest advocates early in his career.
The way it all shook out, ultimately, Ricky was in Rick's ear and in Jeff Gordon's ear for years about me and that they need to give me a shot. And that's why when the fourth team came about, they kind of had me earmarked for the job already. And it was all due to Ricky behind the scenes. And I had no idea until the 04 timeframe probably when it all made sense and I could connect the dots, because Ricky never really said a lot about it. I never asked him for the help. Of course, I appreciated it, but I was never going to cross that line with one of my friends. You know, I wasn't going to ask, hey, can you put the good word in with your dad? Put a good word in for me with your dad. And he was doing it all behind the scenes for a lot of years.
Hendrick Motorsports chief engine builder Randy Dorton was also on the plane that day. Ray Evernham worked with Dorton during his tenure at HMS and thinks his contributions were on a spot in the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
You know, Randy was much more than an engine builder. He was a voice of reason. He used to keep us crazy crew chiefs in line. And, you know, Randy was a good friend to a lot of people. Randy Dorton deserves to be in the NASCAR Hall of Fame because he was so much more than an engine builder. He was certainly one of the original pillars at Hendrick and a mentor to many of us. Randy, I can't tell you how many times Randy would counsel Jeff and I or the other crew chiefs or help lead us in a direction. So Randy was, again, a good friend. And as I said, it was very, very difficult when all that happened with, you know, Ricky, John, the girls, you know, go on. But, Randy certainly is a person that I missed his counsel.
In total, 10 lives were lost that day. Ricky Hendrick, Randy Dorton, Hendrick Motorsports team president John Hendrick, and his twin daughters, Kimberly and Jennifer Hendrick, Hendrick Motorsports general manager Jeff Turner, DuPont executive Joe Jackson, Tony Stewart's personal pilot Scott Lathrop, and pilots of the aircraft Richard Tracy and Elizabeth Morrison. Instead of returning home after the race, Jeff Gordon, along with Ken Schrader, went to the Hendrick house to mourn with the family.
And I went to Rick and Linda's, you know, house that night. Schrader and I did, and I mean that was just so tough, you know. Tears were just, you know, pouring down everybody's faces in that room, and that's when it really, really sunk in for me.
Chad Knaus also went to Mr. Hendrick's house that night, and also remembers the rallying cry to the entire organization Rick gave just days later.
My first thought was Mr. H. And Mrs. Hendrick. So we got all done, right? We got all wrapped up and did, you know, the necessities, got the car in the truck, did the bubble blow tear down, all that kind of stuff. And I got my car and I drove as quickly as I could to Charlotte, hopped in the shower, got cleaned up, got on the phone with Mr. H and went to his house and just, you know, went in and gave him a big hug, he and Mrs. Hendrick, and, you know, told him that, you know, I hurt for him and bled for him and didn't know that I was there, you know, to help support them in any way, shape, or form that I possibly could and that I loved them. And, you know, quite honestly, was happy that they weren't there because the future of Hendrick Motorsports now was, you know, in that room. Like, we didn't have anybody else, and it was tough. And they held a group the next day, and we all got together, and we listened, and we spoke, and we said, hey, we're moving forward. We're going to keep pushing because that's what everybody would want us to do. And, you know, they sacrificed their lives, unfortunately, trying to get to the racetrack, right, to be there. Like, that's why they were going, and that's why that happened. So, as a group, you know, we all stood up, all of us at Hendrick Motorsports. There was probably 350, 400 of us at that point, and we just pushed forward to get to Atlanta.
Gordon also remembers being floored at Rick Hendrick's poise throughout the tragedy.
Real question is Rick and Linda, how were they able to do that? Because Rick was at Hendrick Motorsports just days after that, you know, and talking to all the employees, we got all got together, and you know, fortunately in these situations, life goes on, racing goes on, right? And there was another race that we had to get to, and just having Rick's presence there and his strength to say, listen, I'm devastated, we all are, but you know, we're going to have to grieve in our own way, but we have a race to run, and I want you to know that you know, this company is family to me, and you all mean something to me, and we're going to get through this together. That just blew my mind and everybody else's mind, that you know, Rick had just lost his son, and yet he was there giving his time to us, and that's, to me, what gave our entire company strength and gave me personal strength, and we actually rallied around that. Like that sent a very strong message to all of us. I don't know how he did that, I really don't, but he did. And so yeah, it's probably a better question, you know, to ask Rick, because that's what changed it for me and for so many others.
The success of Hendrick Motorsports the rest of that season and in the 20 years that have followed is proof that the legacies of those lost that day have carried on. Continuing to carry on that legacy is something that is on Jeff Gordon's mind anytime he walks into his current office at the Hendrick campus.
Where my office is in Hendrick Motorsports, there's a hallway where there's photos of every person that we lost that day that is a tribute to them and a reminder. And I walk through that hall every single day. And every single day when I come through there, I'm talking to one of them. You know, Ricky probably primarily. I was the closest to Ricky, but Randy and you know, Joe Jackson, folks from you know, DuPont and Jeff Turner. Yeah, it was, man, I mean, John, you know, it's just tough. And I think that, you know, the reminder for us is that how much they contributed, you know, back, and how our message now is, how do we continue to make them proud of what we've done to carry on that spirit and remember them moving forward.
Despite the tragedy, Hendrick Motorsports was more galvanized than ever and in pursuit of another championship. Next week on Chasing History, we'll further document Jimmy Johnson's miraculous run of getting back into championship contention.
15 car lengths in hand, Jimmy Johnson leads off turn four.
Jimmy Johnson will accomplish that feat, winning the last Mountain Dew Southern 500 and making the sweep for 2004 at Darlington. He scores the victory.
Until then, I'm Mike Bagley. For all of us here at the Motor Racing Network, thank you for joining us on NASCAR Live presents 2004 Chasing History.
Spinning your hand up to stopping, yeah. Not a chair, creaky stair, only the engine repair. Crowd spinning your hand, nothing you can't do. Like a long Mickey John, or that kitchen hat on. Crowd spinning your hand up to stopping, yeah.
From outdoor care to home and auto repair, do it with Craftsman. Find the tools, equipment, and storage you need at your local Lowe's, Ace Hardware, or Craftsman.com.
Kyle Larson brings his Chevy and four tires to Sunoco Racing Fuel.
From fueling NASCAR champions on the track for over 20 years to innovating 94 octane, the highest octane on the market, performance is what Sunoco does. All Sunoco fuel at the pump meets the same top-tier standards as the fuel used in NASCAR.
Ryan's not here for Ryan Blaney. Four tires with Sunoco fuel.
From the track to your tank, you can trust Sunoco to help your vehicle perform at its peak. Thank you.